Hi, this is Linda Holmes from Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm here with my buddies, Stephen and Glenn. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Well, we are here to share something very exciting, which is that because it is Pop Culture Happy Hour's 10th birthday this summer, we are having a virtual live event. It is going to be on Thursday, July 30th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Glenn, what do we have on tap?
Well, we got friends of the show, Kumail Nanjiani, and NPR's own Sam Sanders, so two different kinds of superhero.
That sounds pretty exciting. Stephen, what should people do if they want to help shape the quiz that I'm going to be administering?
Well, you can go to nprpresents.org.
All right. We are excited. You can celebrate with us. Again, head to nprpresents.org, and we're going to all have a happy hour together with our buddies, and we'll see you there. Sometimes all it takes to change your life is a cow. In the new film First Cow, director Kelly Reichardt follows two men who meet by chance and come up with a plan to get rich. All they need is a couple of ingredients.
First Cow is a Western, a friendship story, a caper movie, and even a meditation on nature. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about First Cow on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen from his home studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And also joining us from Dubai, we have longtime NPR contributor, culture writer, and critic Bilal Qureshi. Welcome back, Bilal.
Hi, Linda, and hi, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us from so far away. There is not as much setup for this movie as you might usually need. Kelly Reichardt is a director who's always, I think I would say, more interested in journey than destination, more interested in mood than plot in some ways. If you've seen films like Meek's Cutoff, which is also a Western, you know that she does take her time. But this is a pretty unassuming story, at least at first, of a cook whose name is Otis. He goes by Cookie. He's played by John Magaro. He's originally part of a fur trapping expedition. It's 1820 or so in Oregon. But then he meets a guy named King Lou, who is played by Orion Lee, and the two become friends. They eventually hatch a plan. They're going to make money, but they need a cow. And the only cow in the territory, the first cow of the title, belongs to a very nasty local rich guy who is played by the great Toby Jones. That's probably about as much as you need to know. Glenn, tell me what you think about First Cow.
Well, I mean, the words that keep getting applied to Kelly Reichardt are things like quiet, spare, minimalist. And one reason for that is when she frames her characters in nature, she does it in a way that plays up the characters, not really the nature. There's nothing panoramic or sweeping. I mean, it's gorgeous landscape. It's the Pacific Northwest often, but this is not a gorgeous, like, John Ford Western. And one reason for that is many of her films are shot in an aspect ratio that we associate with like old time television screens, not necessarily contemporary television screens, but more square than rectangle. So we stay on the characters, and she's got her themes, right? And she sticks to them. So to look at some of her more recent films, Wendy and Lucy in 2008 was about a woman living out of her car, just scraping to get by. Meek's Cutoff, you mentioned in 2010, was about a wagon train that gets lost. They get low on food and they're going through this empty, scrubby landscape. And it's just their life becomes one of subsistence, basically. Night Moves in 2013 was a thriller, but let's slap a big old asterisk on that term thriller because this is Kelly Reichardt, so it's sort of a thriller. And then Certain Women in 2016, the one right before this one, that was more of a flex for her because it focused on people a little bit more comfortable. So their desperation was more the kind of familiar literary fiction, art house, emotional desperation. Now, this film is set in this incredible, lush, green forest, and yet the living, the day-to-day existence, is grimy and awful because, again, it's about desperation, subsistence, gathering. Like when we first meet Cookie, he's gathering mushrooms, which sets you up for the way this whole movie is going to have some fun with that masculine feminine divide. Because, you know, hunting and trapping are thought of as masculine, and gathering and cooking, for that matter, are thought of as feminine, or at least traditionally so. So all these shots of Cookie whisking the batter or, you know, whatever, sweeping the cabin, that's playing with all these expectations that have gotten drilled to us. So I didn't find it as spare as some of her other work. I think in many ways, this is the warmest film of hers that I've seen because that friendship at the center of it between these two men is so intimate. But fair warning to people who haven't seen a Kelly Reichardt film before, as you mentioned, Linda, this has her deliberateness. One of the opening shots of the film is a barge floating down a river. We see it enter the screen. We see it cross the screen. We see it leave the screen. Takes about a minute. And when that happened, I was like, all right, we're doing this. Okay. All right.
Bilal, tell me what you think about First Cow.
Yeah, I actually would probably not have remembered it even because it sort of came out at the beginning of March, as you, some of you may know, and was sort of then its release was canceled essentially in the cinemas. But I had read about it, and I guess it's the kind of film that, aside from critics raving about it, it wasn't really going to be generating, you know, lots and lots of excitement, as we've all discussed. What I found initially, since I'm in the middle of binge watching Indian Matchmaking on Netflix, my attention span is clearly on a very different kick right now. So I initially found drifting into this drifting film quite challenging. But once I gave into it, I definitely really regretted that I didn't get a chance to see this in the cinema, to be honest with you, because it's a film that really suffers if your phone is sitting next to you. Because I think if you don't have it with you, you allow yourself much more to fall into this forest where it all happens. And, you know, I was thinking as I was watching this too, that it's actually a movie about 1820 and about the settling of America with a Chinese character at the center of it too. So I'm also used to really not thinking of frontier Western settling movies with this kind of protagonist. It's, you know, usually people talk about sort of people of color or the secondary characters. In a way, it's the white guy who's kind of more of the drifter and the follower and kind of a little bit less. I mean, it's this character, King Lu, who's the much more aggressive, for lack of a better term, or present person in this relationship. So I really liked it. And I also just loved how it subverted ideas of masculinity, which I think we associate so much with Westerns in particular, because these are not alpha males. They're quite beta, if I may say so, in that they like to cook, they like to be friends and hear about each other's feelings and make honey brushed.
Oily cakes, the oily cakes.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was actually a very, in a weird way, very Portland and very Oregon, but also just really a really interesting film.
One of the things I really took away is that focus on this close, close friendship that they have. And I think when you talk about the bond between them, I don't think you can say that it overtly plays with the idea of kind of coupleness for them. But as Glenn said, and as Bilal is also saying, there is a kind of a sharing of domestic life that's very important to them. There's also a kind of a, I think without spoiling it, I can say there's kind of an opening image that makes a promise about what you're going to learn in this movie. And it very much sets an expectation of the bond that's between them. This is kind of the framing device in which Alia Shawkat plays a woman with her dog who goes, is out in the woods and finds kind of evidence of them having been there, right? An artifact of their existence, as it were. And then you're kind of circling back through their story to come back to, you know, how that came to be and what their story was. Stephen, what did you think about this film?
I liked it a lot. It's really interesting. When we talk about movies that are slow paced like this, we'll often have this debate of like, is it meditative or is it slow? And for me, I found it meditative. I also found it at times exciting in its own way. I mean, we mentioned in the intro that it is a crime caper, complete with a last big score that's on a scale kind of worthy of its era. It manages to be about seemingly small things, but at the same time, the stakes don't feel low. And I really, really appreciate one thing that Kelly Reichardt does really well is establish her settings in ways that feel true to the era. I think it's really important that this is a story about all of these people who are kind of trying to make their way in this territory, and they're from all over the world. They're all kind of trying to make their fortune in this new world. And so you have people who are Chinese, you have people who are British, you have people who are from Maryland, you have people kind of from all over the place, instead of this kind of homogeneous storytelling that we often get in Westerns. You get a sense of what it must have been like in these very, very desperate circumstances.
To your point too, Stephen, one of the things is that we've been talking a lot about this friendship, but there are actually quite a lot of other characters and actors who appear in the film. And there's a sequence in a saloon where there's a bunch of guys, and you actually do get to see lots of other faces too of those settlers of different kinds and also indigenous people who live in the place that they're settling. And so while it has this central relationship, part of what I also really liked was the cast is actually bigger than I initially anticipated. And there are more faces to see and think about and in a way also contrast with this kindness and gentleness of these two men against the kind of environment that they're in, which is a lot of very harsh people and harsh faces as well.
Yeah. And I think too, it is a film about friendship, and it is a film that, as Bilal says, places the quote-unquote settling of this area in the context of the people who already live there and the experiences of the people who already live there. And Kelly Reichardt has talked somewhat about this, but because it is about this incredibly scarce resource of this cow and these men who have this plan to try to survive and thrive and do what they think they're supposed to do as people who are settling this area, again, settling in scare quotes, I think I like the fact that it becomes a film that is also about, first of all, what right have these two men to the cow belonging to the rich guy, right, who has brought this cow at his own expense, blah, blah, blah. But I think there is also an implication of kind of what right has Toby Jones to the milk of the cow. So it's all sort of, I think it connects the exploitation of one person by another person to the exploitation of nature by humans. So it's kind of like, what does it mean that people who are setting up this economy decide that one person can own an animal and the milk that comes from the animal? Because what right. sense does that make?
Yeah, this is a film about capitalism. It's about how the system is rigged and how attempts to circumvent it are, let's just say, fraught. And what Kelly Reichardt does, this is a common theme in her work, which what she does here, she gives the audience credit for having some intelligence to intuit things. If you watch the face of the kid who's waiting in line for one of their cakes, he doesn't get one because the last one gets sold to the person before him. There's a disappointment on his face for a moment that's a comic, that's like, aw. But she holds on him for a long time for us to see that something's going to go on. So that disappointment is going to curdle into something else. And I think that's one way it circumvents a big pitfall for historical fiction, because Kelly Reichardt has a very modern sociopolitical take, a very modern sensibility. So if your thoughts about capitalism line up with the films, there's always a danger of feeling not pandered to, but catered to in mm-hmm, a way. And mm-hmm. I always worry about that there's something, when that happens, something ahistorical might creep into the story. But I mean, what's the alternative, right? The alternative is for this to be like the myth of the American dream. It's a scrappy startup. It's like, right. you know, you have Cookie going, how I built this to talk about oily cakes. And that's just not what this film wants to be.
I think you're right. The risk is always that the messaging, quote unquote, in a film like this will be all text and no subtext. And that's why I think the fact that she makes a very specific, and I mentioned earlier the kind of the opening image that the whole film seems to be building back to explaining. She makes a very specific decision to under-explain that image. I think she makes a very specific decision about how to end the film that has a restraint to it. And I think that restraint is reflected in the way that she uses the story to get at the points that she's trying to make. But I think it's worth a mention that she, in addition to working on the script and being the director, she does her own editing. And I think when you watch it, you think like, well, of course, because for her, the edit is half of the direction. If you don't have control over the pace, then, you know, all would be lost.
She's also very much a stylist. And I think the movie is also very much about a kind of independent style that she has. And I do think that I remember first hearing about her when there was a lot of conversations around who are the women filmmakers in Hollywood, who still makes movies and gets them made. And you know, in a way, with Kelly Reichardt, and I think it's true of a lot of her films, she's always had her own stamp and her own signature. And I think that's also in of itself yeah. really great, because you know that when you see one of her films, it's about a place that she lives and a place that she keeps returning to, the Pacific Northwest. It has a signature. And I think that's something about her that I also find really exciting, that there could be ideas related to politics or culture, but it's also a vision very much only hers.
Yeah.
And I really respect that.
Yeah.
I also think it's crucial to the tone and setting of this movie. Its use of music, I think, is really, really careful and important to kind of just the overall feel. The score is by the guitarist William Tyler. He's got a number of records that are terrific, and it really adds to just kind of the overall feel of the movie. I also like the fact the music is so crucial. At one point, there's a guy in the town, and he's like playing a fiddle, and it's Stephen Malkmus from Pavement.
Oh, wow.
So there's clearly some thought going into the music here. I really love that.
Yeah. Well, let us know what you think about First Cow. It is available on demand, and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Let us know what you think. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week. And as you know, every week, what is making us happy this week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Glenlivet's new Caribbean Reserve Expression, a new single malt with a bold tropical twist that is selectively finished in barrels that previously held Caribbean rum, offering a sweet and smooth taste. Learn more at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet Caribbean Reserve Single Malt Scotch Whiskey. Enjoy our quality responsibly. 40% alcohol by volume, 80 proof. 2020 imported by the Glenlivet Distilling Company, New York, New York.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. It is time for our favorite segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Stephen, I'm going to go to you first. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
One of my favorite bands, Sylvan Esso, announced that they've got a new album coming out this fall called Free Love. And if you haven't heard Sylvan Esso, an absolutely wonderful, clever, personality-drenched synth-pop band. The singer Amelia Meath is also one of the singers in Mountain Man. She and her partner Nick Sanborn put together these gorgeous, like really rich electronic soundscapes that just bubble with life. They released the first track from the album this week. It's called Ferris Wheel. Let's hear a little bit of it.
I've been seeing you every day. I'm a block in your way. You're looking pretty fine to me. So why are you waiting? When I'm standing in my dancing shoes, I still tap and my knees all bruised. It's a summer, got a lot to prove. Can't wait to do it, can you?
It's such a rich, summery, warm, playful sound. A new Sylvan Esso record is just exactly what I needed in this summer of 2020. The album Free Love doesn't come out until this fall, September 25th. Again, that's Sylvan Esso. The album coming out this fall is Free Love, and I just can't wait for the world to hear it.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Warrior Nun. Say it soft and it's almost like praying. Fantasy series on Netflix. It's about a dead girl who gets an angel's halo implanted in her back and comes back to life with superpowers to join a secret society of demon fighting nuns. Look, is it good? I'm gonna take a pass on that question because it doesn't strike me as relevant to the situation. Because my situation was I had spent a week in Kelly Reichardt land with the gray and the rain and the desperation and the ultra realism and all those dirty, grimy fingernails, and I was just only too happy to take a side trip to sunny Spain, which is where this is set, with the churches and the mansions and the butt-kicking, the copious butt-kicking. Now, I'm only a few episodes in, and I have to say that if there is a fireworks factory, it's taken them a long time to get there, and there's a really annoying voiceover because it's a teen show on Netflix, and that's the law, but the lead is a Portuguese actress named Alba Baptista, playing a warrior nun. That's a little on the nose universe, but I'm going to give it to you. I'm also really liking her mentor, who's called Shotgun Mary, played by Toya Turner. On its own, who knows if it's any good? I don't know. But as an antidote to all this realistic minimalism, a little fantastical maximalism is what I'm in the market for. So that's Warrior Nun on Netflix.
Oh, thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Warrior Nun. All right, Bilal Qureshi, what is making you happy this week?
Well, my sort of pleasure of the week has come from Leanne LaHavas's third album, who's the singer-songwriter from London. And I want to just briefly mention before going into why it's making me so happy that Stephen Thompson was responsible for helping me learn first about her many years ago when you featured her on your end of year All Songs Considered list, I think in 2012, 13, I'm not sure.
2012,
what
yeah.
2012, and I've been a huge fan of hers ever since. And I think in the beginning, Leanne LaHavas was sort of spoken of in the same breath as like sort of other London soul and R&B singers, but she's really a great guitarist, musician, composer, singer. And this third album that she released last Friday, which is called Leanne LaHavas, I think might be my favorite of her three albums. It sort of feels very much her sound, doesn't have a lot of other unnecessary production. It's also just a really lovely summer soul album and kind of an album that is just pleasurable. And I find that that is kind of what I need as an antidote to doom scrolling, which is a term I'm becoming more and more familiar with and familiar with trying to avoid. So I really loved it. It has a beautiful cover of Radiohead's Weird Fishes. And then there's this one particular song I really love called Sour Flower, which is like 7 minutes long and opens with it's a bird song and then moves into kind of classically Leanne La Havas guitar work and beautiful vocals and beautiful lyrics.
No more looking out for someone else but me, fighting an old war, reaching out for something out of reach, keeping my eyes closed so I'll never miss another beat, running my own show. You can find me dancing on my own.
It's just exactly the kind of relaxing song that I need. It's making me very happy. Leanne La Havas' third album. It's just great.
All right. Thank you very much, Bilal Qureshi. Making me happy this week, many of you know of my affection for the ESPN series on television, 30 for 30. I have been treating myself to some of their podcast episodes recently. The 30 for 30 podcast series has done some seasons that have been, you know, one-off episodes, story by story, but they've also done a couple of seasons that dive deeply into one story. And their newest season is called Heavy Metals, and it's about the Karoly gymnastics gym that kind of was dominant in Romanian gymnastics, but then in American gymnastics for quite a while. If you've followed the Believed podcast about the abuse in elite gymnastics or seen any of the documentaries about it, this is a very interesting fit because it touches on those things, but a lot of it is about the power over elite gymnasts that in some ways to me made them vulnerable to abuse, the way that they are belittled and beaten down. It's a really fascinating podcast. They've done a really good job of putting these stories together, and I do recommend them. So that's 30 for 30, the podcast series from ESPN. So very good and making me happy this week. A good chewy podcast series. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Bilal at B. Kilal, B-Q-I-L-A-L. You can find our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, we call it, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It is at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all back here next week when we will be talking about the Starz series P-Valley.
Every business has to figure out what to charge for its product and how to keep out competitors. You know who does this better than anyone else? Drug dealers. On the next episode of Planet Money Summer School, we explain pricing theory with a drug kingpin. Summer School, new classes every Wednesday. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.